Okay, so again, my name's Stéphane Blondin. I'm a postdoc at the Center for Astrophysics in the supernova group led by Bob Kirshner. I'm going to present something today which is, of course, related to supernova, but only mildly so to the actual accretion explosion process. What I'm going to present today is a tool, essentially a spectral comparison tool, which is used routinely by members like of the Essence High Redshift Supernova 1A search, but also that can be used for model comparison, so comparing models to observations, and that's something that I'm also exploring currently with Alexei Kokolov, who contacted me about this. This is work that I've done in collaboration with John Tonry at the IFA in Hawaii, and well, the reason I'm speaking about this is this is what I'm currently working on, and I'm going to probably submit the paper next week, so it will be also KITP paper. There's this AstroPH preprint, which is just a conference proceeding where you can look some of this thing up. So just quick layout. Obviously, supernova classification is an issue that we've touched upon very briefly yesterday, and I know it's a touchy subject even amongst people working in the field. And supernova classification, as you know, is purely empirical for now, and if one of the results from this workshop would be to come up with a classification scheme based on actual physical properties of the explosion and the subsequent radio transfer, that would be great. So the technique I'm going to talk about is simple cross-correlation technique based on Tonry and Davis algorithm developed in the late 70s. I'll briefly mention that for those who aren't familiar with it. And the original purpose was to use this to determine the redshift of supernova based on a single supernova spectrum for these high redshift type 1a supernova searches. You can also place constraints on the phase from a single spectrum, and I'll end briefly with the type determination. So
is it for any use? I mean, space and
well, it's based on spectra, so I mean, you know,
I mean, the technique is it max? It's general, right?
Yeah, it's very general.
For example, it's not there will be a supposed to be a spectrograph.
Yeah, sure. Maybe it's just
you can apply this.
Yeah, of course.
No
yeah. So of course the motivation is to classify new supernovae and with their spectra, select supernovae of a given type for these large surveys that are ongoing. And of course, you know, cosmology that require supernovae to indeed be of the right type and to have an accurate redshift to build the Hubble diagram. But it also can be used for comparative studies of supernova types and, again, comparisons of models with synthetic spectra with observed ones. So this is a diagram that some of you may not have seen that often, but just like to bring it up. It shows the number of supernovae discovered since 1950. Up to today, so roughly 4,000 discovered since 1006, and half of them were discovered since 2000. And I mean, this plot, if you know, in a couple of years or 3 years from now, with PanTAS 1 going online, I'll be interested to see how this plot evolves. All of this, you probably need a logarithmic scale for that. But it's still a field, I'd like to point this out, that would also radically change in the years to come, where roughly 50% of the discoveries are made by amateurs. And the rest are divided amongst dedicated surveys, both at low and high redshift. That's based on all the numbers, you know, in the IAU circulars up to 2006. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And what is the prediction? I mean, if you take a look at what we're discussing yesterday,
the PS1, I don't know. PanSTARRS will probably discover, I don't know. You know, several thousand a year. I don't know what the exact prediction is, but maybe 10,000 a year. So I mean, this will just change this diagram radically. Yes. Yeah. These were. Yeah.
Not 10
or 6. Well. That's right. So. Well, those that have a type announced in an IAU circular. So the rules of declaring supernova being of a certain type of change in the IAU, now you do require a classification spectrum, which you didn't used to in the past.
But you should zoom up. Many of you might not have.
That's also true. Yeah.
what's the highest redshift?
So highest redshift would be 1.7, yeah. So the other use, of course, is to select supernova a given type for high redshift supernova searches. So I mean, I won't. That's just to make that statement. The idea is that in these high redshift searches, the signal you obtain from a spectrum is typically fairly low. I'll show examples of that. And the confusion with supernovae of other types, which you don't want in your sample, since the idea is to use these type 1As to normalize their luminosity to determine the distance, so you don't want to be contaminated by supernovae of other types. So this is what a tool like this can do. So we know the supernova classification scheme is not flawless, basically. I mean, you have the two main types, which don't map out into the main differences that are between the explosion mechanism, so thermonuclear disruption of a white dwarf, and the collapse of the core of a massive star, which is the 1DC in the type 2. That is based in part on the fact that the classification system was built on an empirical scheme, which is the identification of certain features in the optical spectra around maximum light. And we'll see that sometimes identifying which transition causes which feature in a spectrum is not that obvious, and I have a nice illustration of that. And also illustrate the difficulty of classifying these at high redshift. So when we think about classifying astrophysical objects on a large scheme, this is the picture that comes to mind. You've probably seen this picture before. This is from Harvard College Observatory back in the early 20th century, where Annie Cannon and her group classified by hand, or by eye, I should say, over 200,000 stars in this sequence, you know, OB-Fine-Kismi. And that sequence is a sequence in temperature, of course, but it's also a sequence that maps out physical properties of stars into a classification scheme. It's also a sequence in mass it can relate the certain spectral features like the equivalent widths of the Bollinger series to the surface gravity and therefore a mass. It's not that straightforward to do something similar for supernova spectra. And one of the problems is the issue of line identification, which I illustrate here, not for a type 1A supernova, but this is a type 2 supernova spectrum. This is computed by using CMFGen model as modified by Luc Dessart. And this is a comparison that I like because there you have a model for a type 2 supernova, and here a model for Eta Carinae, which is a luminous blue variable. And the chemical composition is the same for these two models. The only thing that changes, of course, is here you have the velocity field of the order of several thousands of kilometers per second that smears out all of these features, which are real. I mean, this is a model. There's no noise in here. And so you can see to map out certain features to certain transitions becomes difficult just because they overlap so much. In type 1A supernova, that is increasingly a problem, especially at shorter wavelengths where the iron peak elements just blanket or deplete most of the flux. Mentioned the problem of identification at high redshifts. Of course, as you observe these at higher redshifts, the signal is largely degraded. And what I'm going to show here is just how the signal is degraded and plotting this in rest wavelength. So instead of showing these shifting towards the red as you go higher in redshift, I'll just show the effect, what you're missing out when you observe these spectra with a typical optical spectrograph. So you'll see the noise degrading, and this hashed area, which symbolizes what you're missing at high redshift as you go to redshift to the half, for instance. So that's that's the sort of data that these high redshift searches have to deal with. Of course, you know, the signal you lose in that part of the spectrum, you gain in the blue part. However, as I said, you know, flux is severely depleted in those regions, and the actual UV properties, I don't know if there'll be a talk about that specifically, but the UV properties, for instance, of type 1A supernova is not something that has been extensively studied and for that, you know, practical reason. And so those redshifts, you get, for instance, a defining feature of type 1A supernova, this absorption due to silicon 2, which you don't have access to. You have to rely on features that are blueward of this. And of course, there the distinction between, let's say, type 1A and type 1C, for instance, becomes more and more problematic. And of course, you go to higher redshift in extreme cases. That's right, or a tool like this. So this is a cross-correlation tool, again, that's based on the Toner and Davis algorithm, which I'll briefly present. That's just an acronym that we have to find when planned public release of such a code. And so I'll just mention very briefly how this technique works and how it can be applied just to comparing spectra amongst themselves. So it's very basic, cross-correlation technique. The idea is that you have an input spectrum, S of N, where N is just a bin index. Here I'm showing it a redshift of a half, so it's that red noisy thing. And then you have template spectra of all types and spanning a range of phases which you want, so T subscript I. And the idea is to find the lag, delta, and then expressed in log wavelength, I'll explain why in a minute, that maximizes the correlation between the input and the template spectra. And alpha here is just an arbitrary scaling constant, since you don't want to depend on the absolute flux level between the spectra, obviously. So you correlate an input spectrum with a database of supernova spectra, and this is what this database currently looks like. This is the phase distribution, so the supernova phase is expressed in days for maximum light, except for the type 2, where you can sometimes infer the actual date of explosion, so this is expressed in days from explosion. So this is phase distribution for all the different types here, 1A, 1B, 1C, and type 2. And notice that on the y-axis there for the core collapse supernovae, the it only goes up to about 30 here. For the 1As, it goes up to 100. And that's, again, that's just a direct consequence of the observer or interest bias that was driven by their cosmological application of type 1A. People choose to follow these up, and therefore we have more of them. So there will be a natural bias when you're trying to use such a tool, let's say, to determine the type of an input spectrum. You'll tend to have some sort of artificial attractor solution towards identifying, preferentially determining the type of an input spectrum to be a type 1A, and so you have to be careful. I'm sorry?
What defines normal and other here?
So other in case of type 1A, for instance, those would be the 91T, 91BG, and the...
That don't fit the template become other?
No. I mean, I have... These are all the templates that are in the database. This is just for illustrative purposes. What I call the normal ones are ones that are, represent 80% of the sample, basically. So they're not the 91T-like supernovae, they're not the 91BG-like, and they're not the wackos, the duds, as we called them yesterday.
Okay, so go to the type 2s, then. What defines normal type 2?
So there, normal would be the type 2, what I call the type 2 plateau, for instance. 87A, which was the best study type 2, is still considered peculiar in many respects. But I mean, that's just, again, just for illustrative purposes, it doesn't have a real impact
on. Just to make sure, this is a database of spectra against which you're going to cross correlate.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
Now, the other, they include the normal ones too, because they seem to dominate.
So that's why it's you can see in type 1B already. That's a direct consequence of the classification scheme was elaborated at a time where there were very few representatives of each subtype. So you get into some sort of a weird situation where for type 1B, for instance, things that don't look like your nominal type 1B, which was observed in the early 80s, you would say, oh well, it looks most like a type 1B. It has obvious helium lines in the spectrum, but it doesn't look like my nominal one, so I'll classify it as a peculiar one. So you have a situation where you have more peculiar than normal.
So those are really the peculiar ones.
No, the blue is the sum, right?
No.
Well, they're put on top of the yellow one. Right.
Yeah.
You still
right.
The yellow one,
So if you...
Well, if you look at one particular value, like 10 for the blue, the other, is that 10?
Yeah, sorry.
10 or other, or is it...
Yeah, sorry. If you want the other, you have to subtract that yellow histogram from the blue. But that's, you can sort of integrate by eye. You can see that they're more other than normal.
You should make clear, these are often spectra of the same supernova.
Yeah, so...
Different
Yes, so I mean, there you get the number of typical number of the number of objects according to each type and the number of spectra we have for each.
So the sociology there is that others are more observed than
there? That's right.
The numbers are super nerdy, wouldn't be so...
Well, even, you know, the numbers there that are more... I mean, you still have this observer bias where you choose to follow up spectroscopically things that don't look like, you know, they're your nominal objects.
But does this suggest that maybe the template base should be larger?
Oh, yeah, definitely for those. I mean, you know, we're... I've run these Monte Carlos to see how, you know, what the ideal, what sort of phase distribution you would need to obtain certain accuracy in redshift phase and type determination, pretty much complete for the type 1A, as one would expect. And we're definitely not complete for the other subtypes. But there is, I mean, there is ongoing effort to, and, you know, the CFA is part of this, to complete this, the type 1BC database, just having a systematic follow-up. And those have regained interest in type 1C in particular through the, you know, link with, established link with gamma ray bursts. So there's also, you know, possibility that, that this will hopefully increase in the near future.
You can also argue that this is just set as that 1As are very homologous group. They're very similar to each other, while the other ones are, you know, all over the
place. Because if the entry is so...
Yeah, I
mean... fuzzy. I mean, how can you...
Well, anyway, let's not. Let's go on. Time to move on. So there's some sort of pre-processing magic done to the spectrum. Both the input and the spectrum in the database follow these sort of steps of pre-processing. So there's an example of an input spectrum. The first step is to bin it on a logarithmic wavelength axis, such that basically a velocity shift or a redshift corresponds to a uniform linear shift in log lambda. That's just for computational ease. Then the next step is literally to flatten the spectrum. So remove all color information and divide out some sort of, I stress, pseudo continuum from the spectra. There's no attempt to determine, you know, what the continuum would be in type 1A. It would probably lie right down over here. But the idea is to remove all color information and rely only on the relative strength and position of these broad features in the spectra. And so you're removing some information, but it actually works pretty well. And the fact that it works can tell you something about such a tool. And then the last step is, I mean, you know that these spectra, I mean, just due to the expansion velocity, consist of features which are intrinsically fairly broad. And so all of the higher frequency signal in there is most likely to be either noise or signal from the underlying galaxy. So you can filter it out with a, you know, bandpass filter, for instance, in Fourier space. So that's what's done to the input spectra, just to try and maximize the supernova signal in both the input and the template spectra.
What about the continuum? What is physically
Are you referring to this?
Yeah, you have to subtract the continuum.
Yeah, it's not a physical continuum at all. I mean, the idea is, I mean, literally, it's, you know, fit a sort of low order polynomial to your spectrum and divide that out. The mean is zero, basically.
I'm wondering if there's some information there, you know.
No, I mean, yeah. Ideally, you would want your input or template spectra to be free from galaxy light, for instance. But I mean, the actual continua in type 1A supernova spectra, I mean, most of it is, you know, electron scattering. But it's especially in the blue part of the spectrum, it's really dominated by line opacity, anyway. So I mean, the continuum really lies. So the pseudo continuum, what you think is a continuum, is just the result of, you know, overlapping of thousands or several thousands of lines. I'll skip on that basically. So this is what a typical template would look like in the database. It's looking for a type 1A supernova 1992A, and you see all the spectra have been flattened here, and there I show it increasing in phase, so going from 5 days before maximum light to roughly a month after maximum light. And you see that the wavelength coverage does vary from one epoch to the other. We just had some UV spectra from here. And this is course, the bus is supernova, so I have to show it. So in a cross-correlation, this is what a correlation function looks like, the normalized correlation function. This is this thin black line here. And the advantage of such a technique is you're really able to quantify the quality of a correlation, which is related both to the height of the correlation peak, but also to this is in red, the anti-symmetric component of the correlation function about the correlation redshift. And so the ratio of the height of this peak, H, to the RMS of this anti-symmetric component gives you some sort of quality parameter, which Tony and Davis called the R value, and which enables you to quantify the quality of a correlation. So, for instance, if you want to compare, if you have a synthetic spectrum and see how well it matches to the observed spectrum you're trying to model, this would be a way to quantify that, other than just by looking by eye and plotting one over the other. And so this is what it illustrated here for autocorrelation, where you have a peak H equals 1 in normalized correlation amplitude. It's perfectly symmetric about the correlation redshift, so there's no anti-symmetric component, so the RMS is 0, so R tends to infinity. For a good correlation, you have a clear correlation peak that dominates over the others and not too much structure in the anti-symmetric component. And here, for poor correlations, you have peaks of equal heights, and this is for a type 1a supernova spectrum. You see that they're degenerate in redshift separated by 0.2 roughly. That's plus or minus 30,000 kilometers per second, and that's typical span of a feature. This is sort of the from the blue edge of the absorption to the red edge of the emission. That's roughly what explains this degeneracy here. So we have this R value, which is further weighted by an overlap between the template spectrum, and the template spectrum at the correlation redshift. And it's important to have that, again, because the features in supernova spectra are so intrinsically broad that you can have an excellent correlation, but if you don't include enough of these features, if this overlap expressed here as a logarithmic ratio is not large enough, the fact that you have a high R value or a good correlation could be meaningless. So I'm just going to show then briefly some results of redshift and phase determination using this technique by comparing it with external measurements. And I'll briefly mention the covariance that exists between these two quantities. So this is how well such a technique does in determining the redshift of an input spectrum. So these are 47 type 1a supernova spectra in this redshift range, so out to a redshift of 0.8 roughly, data from the ESSENCE survey. And what I'm plotting here is the redshift as determined from this cross-correlation technique versus the redshift when it was available of the host galaxy, and which is typically accurate to 200 kilometers per second, which is just the typical velocity dispersion in galaxies, when spirals and less in ellipticals. And so you do expect, if this technique works well, to have a nice one-to-one correspondence with a small scatter, which you indeed do. And the scatter is below 0.01, again, which is almost a physical limit, just again due to the intrinsic width of the features. You can't expect to do a whole lot better than that. So that's also to show that the use of type 1a supernovae in cosmology really relies on being able to determine the redshift accurately. And I'm showing the sample of total type 1a supernovae is obviously a lot larger than this, but for roughly half of them, we don't have an independent measurement of the redshift through the host galaxy, so such a technique is valuable. For the phase determination, I'm showing here a bolometric light curve of type 1a supernova, and at different phases show the corresponding spectra, which evolves, again, on the scale of a few days. And for the bulk of the type 1a supernova sample, actually, this evolutionary sequence is fairly predictable. And so from a single spectrum, you can actually determine the phase to relatively high accuracy without a light curve. And so using this cross-correlation technique, you determine a phase in the rest frame of the supernova. And if you compare it to the phase that you obtain by the light curve, which is in the observer frame, so you have to correct for the the GR 1 plus Z time dilation factor, you do expect, again, a 1-to-1 correspondence. Of course, scatter is also, scattered about 3 days around the 1-to-1 correspondence between the cross-correlation phase and the what I call the light curve phase here. There are two points here that are slightly off by several standard deviations of the 1-to-1 correspondence. That's just due to the lack of templates at those phases, so you get artificial attractor solutions at higher phases.
How late do your templates go?
Well, I'm showing it 50 days past maximum, but it goes, I mean, there are a few, you know, nebula spectra also. Yeah, yeah.
It looks like there might be some residuals
in the middle. Yeah.
Is that meaningful at all?
No, I mean, the mean residual is maybe, it is negative, it's minus 0.3 or something, minus 0.4, I think it's probably a visual effect here. So there is a covariance between these two quantities. I'm just illustrating that with a very, toy cartoon movie, which I'll just play once and then comment. So what we have here is this our toy supernova observer here. This is the tau greater than one region and velocity vectors here. So it's just homologous expansion. And these are surfaces of iso-projected velocity, which are perpendicular to the line of sight, just due to the nature of the expansion. And this is what a typical P-Cygni profile, so a line profile that you would get from such a configuration. So here with a blue-shifted absorption, which, as the phase of the supernova progresses, obviously the tau equal one layer recedes in the ejector of the supernova, although the whole system is expanding. And so the position of this maximum absorption, which in this ideal model occurs at the boundary here between the optically thick and optically thin region, just shifts redward in wavelengths. So what that means is, if you using this technique, if you tend to overestimate the phase of your spectrum, all the features will have shifted slightly towards the red, and the impact will mean that you will underestimate the redshift. So there's an anti-correlation between the two, and that's what's just shown here is the phase residuals against the redshift residuals, and you see there's a overestimate of the phase for roughly 3 days leads to an underestimate of the redshift, roughly 0.01. I'm sorry?
You could hang that in the hallway. It's just like some of the features.
You should see it from space.
So I'll just end, since I don't have too much time, just on one example. I had two there, but applying such a technique to determining the type, and again, this code was originally developed for this high redshift type 1a supernova search. So to determine the redshift, but also to ensure that you weren't contaminated by supernovae of other type. And the greatest concern in these searches is to have a supernova type 1c that sort of pollute your sample. And if you mistakenly, if you think that they are type 1a and you correct their luminosity in the same way you do for type 1a supernovae, you get a weird impact in the Hubble diagram. So I'm going to focus on that example there before moving to my conclusion slide. So what I'm showing here is what happens if I throw at this code a type 1c supernova around maximum light, between 5 and plus or minus 5 days from maximum. Here I show an example of a quote-unquote normal type 1c supernova and a quote-unquote normal type 1a supernova here in green at a redshift of 0.3, so this is what you would be missing with a typical spectrograph. And what I'm looking at is what is the fraction of templates that I would recover in my database that match the type of the input spectrum. Okay, as a function of this parameter, which is R times the overlap, so the higher this value, the better the correlation.
How do you define the type? Do you have a threshold on the value of the peak?
Sorry.
Or you know the type of the template and.
Well, this is just it's just simulation. So I know the type. The type of your templates.
So you're not typing it from this technique.
Well, see.
Yes, I mean, that's the
okay. I'm getting ahead.
So what you see is if you look at the fraction of templates that match the type of the input spectrum, okay, which is this blue curve in this case, is the normal one sees, and you expect it to increase with, you know, the better the correlation gets. Okay, and the dominating source of confusion for these objects high redshift would be type 1A. So you would mistake a type 1C for a type 1A. And that's that green curve here, which you see the fraction decreases as the correlation improves.
Okay.
And then the confusion with supernovae of other types stays relatively low for all quality. Okay. And so this is, I'm just showing the effect of adding a pry. If you have a pry on the redshift, let's say if you know the redshift from the host galaxy, if you have a pry on the phase, so if you have a light curve and you have a rough idea of the phase, and if you have a combined pry on the two, how these curves evolve. So that's a redshift of 0.3, which is still relatively low in the redshift range for these high redshift searches. If you go to redshift of 0.5, what you start seeing is that you're not able to recover the 1C supernova in your database, and in fact you tend to confuse, you know, even for high quality correlations, you tend to confuse it with 1As or supernovae of other types. So you have to use alternative arguments, like the shape of the light curve, the color, the expected magnitude of a type 1C supernova, that redshift, etc. The type of the host galaxy, etc. However, if you do have a pry on the redshift, or a pry on the phase, or a pry on both, then in that case you start to recover the 1Cs in your database. But I mean, just to illustrate that there's an issue in these high redshift searches is the confusion with supernovae of other types. So I'm just 2 minutes, so I'll just very quickly end here. So while I present this tool, which is used to determine types, in redshifts and all this, potential application which could be of interest in during this workshop is the actual comparison between synthetic spectra and observed spectra using this tool, and to quantify the quality of how well your model matches an observation. And this, as I said, I'm going to submit a paper next week, and the plan is to release the code publicly shortly after that. So, thank you.
We have time for questions.
But there were some during.
Yeah. In terms of the population of the various types in the database, how much more important is the observer bias as opposed to the intrinsic rates and the intrinsic brightness distributions?
Well, if you look at the histograms that I show, these are all local, well, nearby spectra that form your database. So there's certainly a rate folded in there, but I think this is just, for the moment, you can just interpret this as an observer bias purely. I mean, to see the domination of type 1A over all the other types is just a choice to follow up those spectra. In the database, we privilege supernovae for which we have a large number of epochs of spectroscopy.
And who makes that choice?
Who makes it? Well, now...
And you, right?
Well, as of last year, yeah. But, I mean...
Yeah.
That's right. So, but, I mean, that is changing, as I said. There is regained interest for type 1C supernovae for, their link with gamma ray bursts, so the hope is to... And all of type 1B, the whole sequence between that goes from type 2, type 1B to type 1C, as also needs to be established, and they're linked with the progenitor. So, regain interest in non-1A should populate those histograms there.
But the point is, we have a spectrograph at our observatory in Arizona. We can tell them what to observe, and so we get long series of these spectra quite regularly. Stefan really is running that, so you're really the one who decides which of the supernovae we will follow.
Yeah,
how densely they will be sampled, given the constraints of time and weather. Right.
Yes, but yeah,
you're just being honest.
Well, yeah. But it's all my fault, basically.
On your last slides, where you were looking at the effect of priors and RLAP in terms of being able to distinguish, to do the categorization, in practice, what kind of, can you push RLAP higher by doing what? In other words, if I'm down at 2, I'm dead, and if I'm up at 8, I'm in good shape. How do I get from 2 to 8 in RLAP?
Well, I mean, that's just, you know, it's just correlation.
If
you build a better spectrum.
Yeah.
This is the kind of answer I'm
trying. Well, see, what, I mean,
there isn't really an issue with the signal-to-noise ratio of your template spectra, for instance. There tends to be fairly high. But one of the issues is just, you know, wavelength coverage. As you try to identify these at high
so
redshift.
So LAP is better than R in terms of...
Well, I mean, you want a significant, you know, sufficient overlap. But of course, you know, redshift 0.7, most of the spectra that you're saying, that you have in your database are, you know, optical wavelengths. Just for, again, I mean, that's...
So is that a potential...
One thing these high redshift for type 1A against supernova searches can bring are, of course, you know, rest frame UV spectra of these and that are folded in as templates also for this technique. But it's true that the, you know, unless we come up with a different classification scheme, the typing relies on, you know, the optical spectra, the feature in the optical spectra. So in the UV, the differences on that as apparent.
In this particular case, is it just the loss of the silicon that causes this?
No, not just the loss of the silicon. I mean, I've done various tests to see which sort of wavelength regions matter most for the type. And I mean, you can. The overall pattern is really important. I mean, it's just there in this case. What you're losing is there aren't that many blueward of this in your database. That's what's really killing you. If there were more UV spectra or near UV spectra and supernovae of all types, including 1Cs and 1As, then that would be a different story.
I mean, just normally you look at a spectrum and it has strong silicon 2 with the 6,000 angstroms, you say, well, that's got to be a 1A. But you shifted it so that your blank region is now no longer including the silicon, and so your blue line dies instead of going up. So
that's part of it, but I mean, removing the silicon alone, if I choose to artificially map it out and see how it affects the correlation or the type determination, that it does affect it somewhat, but it's, you know, it doesn't make the whole thing crash. It really is, you know, the overall pattern of the features. So you're doing the, you know, the sulfur features and the silicon features at 4,000 angstrom also, and calcium dip.
But suppose I had $500 million and I wanted to build a satellite and I wanted to get spectra of supernovae and I wanted to be sure I knew the 1As from the 1Cs. Wouldn't you recommend that I go into the infrared?
Yes, yeah.
So that, you know, to capture that that is being lost. I mean, that's Peter's point, I think. And, you know, somebody's going to build a satellite.
With $500 million.
Not in our lifetime.
No. In our lifetime. Well, your lifetime. No. So I think it's a really important question to see where the sensitivity is and what, you know.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, go red. Like that's sort of depth that I'm not able to do currently because I have many observations of those wavelengths. But.
Well, we could make them up.
Yeah.
Anyways. Okay, thank you very much, sir. Okay, and now we have a couple minutes of change.